Good afternoon or good morning. This is Professor Nick Burnett, and I'm here to talk to you today about sexual harassment. This is an issue that, frankly, the textbook does not spend a lot of time on, and it's something that I think we need to spend some time on because it is an important and significant issue in modern organizations. It is something that can undermine small businesses rather easily, and it's something, frankly, that I believe that people going into the business world have an ethical responsibility to understand, to work to make the workplace safe for their workers, and to meet their obligations to make sure that people can work in an environment without feeling sexually threatened or intimidated. I talk about this not only because I think it's an important and significant issue for businesses, but also because I believe that I can help bring a different perspective than you may have already been exposed to on this issue. I mean, of course, it's possible to look at sexual harassment as a legal issue. That is, organizations have certain legal responsibilities, and it's the mandate of the organization to follow the law, or that they need to do certain things in order to protect themselves from lawsuits. That's certainly one perspective on sexual harassment. It is possible to look at sexual harassment as a phenomenon entirely from the statutory perspective. That is, just looking at what laws impact sexual harassment. But the perspective that I hope to bring to you today, to give you a sense of today, is to understand sexual harassment as a communication phenomenon. By doing so, I'm not trying to downplay the importance of sexual harassment. I am not trying to make it seem less important or less threatening than it is, but simply that one of the things that my field can help to bring to people in business is a sense in which we give you another lens through which you can look at the important issues affecting a business. And so that's why we're going to be talking today a bit as sexual harassment as a communication phenomenon. I'm going to talk about it as in perspective of the victims of sexual harassment. I'm going to talk about it about what organizations can do and what you as potentially representatives of these organizations are required to do in order to help deal with this problem. As always, it's important, I think, to talk about sexual harassment or any concept that we've been discussing this semester through the terms of a definition, so that we know what's kind of out there and what people are talking about when they're talking about legally what is sexual harassment. The definition that you see on the first slide of the PowerPoint slides comes from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This is a definition that's, I think, more or less stood the test of time. It is the basis for a number of state laws, and it's the basis for a number of federal laws. But let's work slowly through this definition so everybody understands where we're talking about. They define sexual harassment as unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature, if, and then there are three conditions for that if. If submission is made a condition of employment, that's the sleep with me or you don't get the job kind of sexual harassment. The second is submission to or rejection of the conduct is the basis for an employment decision. And unfortunately, that is the sleep with me or you don't get the promotion kind of sexual harassment. And then there's finally the one that, in fact, out in the workplace is perhaps the most widespread, it is certainly the most reported, is that the conduct seriously affects an employee's work performance or creates a hostile, intimidating, or offensive work environment. So you have a very sophisticated and complex definition here. It takes a while to kind of work through that. But remember, it's not a sexual advance. It is not just a request for sexual favor. There are these other conditions which have to be met for the conduct to legally be called sexual harassment. The sources of the sexual harassment laws are varied, and they are multi-jurisdictional, which means that you can have local laws regarding sexual harassment, you can have a state law regarding sexual harassment, and in fact you have federal laws regarding sexual harassment. And employers have to be worried and concerned and knowledgeable about the legal environment that affects them. So not everything that I'm going to be talking about today affects everybody across the United States. But in fact, there are two federal laws which form the basis for federal sexual harassment suits. And they are Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and Title, particularly for colleges, Title IX of the Higher Education Reauthorization Act of 1972. Both of these laws have explicit requirements against sexual discrimination, and it is those laws that are the basis for sexual harassment law. Within the state of California, the overarching law that guides or controls the conduct related to sexual harassment is the Fair Employment and Housing Act. But perhaps most significantly for the state of California and most recently in our state, California passed what is probably the most comprehensive, the most demanding law related to employers and sexual harassment. It went into effect January 1st of 2005, and it makes some very specific requirements upon employers so that if you are in a company that has more than 50 employees, you are subject to this AB 1825. And what it says is that employees in these companies of at least that size must be given, and there are some qualifying terms here, must be given interactive sexual harassment training at least once every 2 years. So it's not enough to do it once. It has to be done every 2 years. And it has to be done within 6 months of a promotion. So, for instance, if somebody was a line worker, they're promoted to being a supervisor, that company can't simply wait until the next round of sexual harassment training when the rest of the supervisors are being trained. You have to make special provisions to make sure that that person who is being promoted to a supervisory position gets training within 6 months of that promotion. The reason this is so important, and the reason these kind of statutory requirements are so important, is that they form the basis for a defense should your company be charged, or should your company have a charge of sexual harassment leveled against it. In a manner, they are a way of saying to the participants involved in a court case that we've met the requirements of state law. We made a good faith effort to do everything that's required by the state of California to punish us any more than that. To make us responsible for anything beyond that is really unfair because companies have to be able to kind of proceed in a kind of more or less certain regulatory environment. If you turn around and keep punishing companies every time there's an infraction, they're going to have a very difficult regulatory environment overall. One of the reasons AB 1825 requires that people who are promoted to supervisory positions have to have training within 6 months is that there's actually pretty good research that suggests that when people in organizations make mistakes, when sexual harassment is charged, what they find is that often it's the people who've just recently been promoted who don't appreciate the change in their status from a subordinate to a supervisor. And that's a difficult mindset for some people to deal with. It was difficult, frankly, when I went from simply being a faculty member in my department to being the chair of my department. I had to appreciate the fact that people were no longer simply interacting with me as a colleague, but in fact, they were now interacting with me as a superior versus a subordinate. And that's a difficult thing to remember. And one of the things that this AB 1825 training is really meant to do is to give supervisors a chance to appreciate that fact, that even they don't see their interactions as having changed when they've gotten promoted. The people around them, and certainly the people reporting to them, will see it as an important change. This law is relatively new. It's only been in place since January 1st, 2005. One of the important things about the law is that it gives specific amounts of time for the training. That is, not only does it have to happen every 2 years, the law actually says you have to have 2 hours of training every 2 years, and that training has to be interactive. that's, I think, an important regulatory issue, because I think some companies in the past may have simply dealt with sexual harassment by sitting people down in front of a video, and you know, they get the talking head lecture for the next 45 minutes. That will not be sufficient. The legislation specifically says that the training has to be interactive. So whether it actually has to be live with a live instructor, or whether it's computer-based with a chance to specifically ask questions, and that the individual participants in the training have to respond during the course of the training. I can tell you that at Sac State and within the CSU system, what they've done is they've designed actually a very good computer-based interactive training that we all had to go through by January 1st of 2005, and which we will, of course, have to update as soon as we reach our two-year anniversary with all of that. If somebody is promoted to a position of authority over other people, they, of course, also have to get that sexual harassment training within 6 months of a promotion. This regulatory environment that's been established in California has been called by some the Sexual Harassment Trainers Full Employment Act, and there's some truth to that, because this did create a lot of work for consultants, for trainers, for law firms, because it was very important for companies to comply with this. Because companies that are out of compliance with AB 1825 are dramatically more vulnerable should there be a charge of sexual harassment. When it gets to court and the people prosecuting the lawsuit, the people who are bringing the lawsuit on behalf of somebody who feels victimized, if they're able to demonstrate that the company was out of compliance, their ability to defend themselves from this lawsuit is dramatically impacted. So, in fact, some of the materials that I have read, that even if you're a company that has fewer than 50 employees, still needs to think seriously about making sure that your employees have this kind of training, because frankly, when you get into court or when you come before some kind of regulatory authority being charged with sexual harassment, they're not going to care whether you only have 40 employees or not. They're going to say, gee, this is the industry standard. Why weren't you doing it too? And that's a very good point that I think companies need to consider. And as folks going out into the workplace, as folks starting up new businesses, you all need to consider very carefully what your organization is doing in terms of sexual harassment. Because companies, even ones that should know better, often don't make the right choices. A few years ago, there was a very dramatic choice or a dramatic instance of sexual harassment. A woman went to work for a big law firm, a very large, hundreds of attorneys law firm on the peninsula just south of San Francisco. She was, in fact, going to be one of the legal secretaries and personal secretaries to the managing partner of this law firm. One of the things that she almost immediately found to be a little odd was that her employer, this managing partner in this large, large law firm, asked her to be sure to, when she was coming into work, to wear blouses that had pockets on the front of them. And the reason he was very adamant about that is that what he liked to do when he was dictating a letter or a memo is he would drop M&Ms into the pockets of her blouse and then go fishing them out. As disgusting as that sounds, that's what he did. This woman, after just being at work for a couple of weeks, was so horrified by this that she left even before the end of her one-month probationary period. She was so traumatized by all of this because when she went to other people in the law firm to complain about what she thought was just obvious sexual harassment, the law firm actually rallied around and defended the partner instead of protecting the secretary. It took this woman a long time to find a law firm in the area that was willing to sue this enormous law firm with all these legal resources. But when she did, and when she finally told her story in court, and when a jury of her peers listened to what she had gone through, when all was said and done, she was given over $1 million in damages for this less than 3 week period, because she had been so traumatized by the notion of this guy fishing around in her blouse for M&Ms, but the law firm was also, and this person was also awarded punitive damages on the order of $6 million, so that the total cost of the loss in this case to this giant law firm was like $7 million, which in the great scheme of things may not have been a huge amount of money for this enormous law firm, but it was a significant kick. And the reason the punitive damages were there were, in a sense, to send a notice to other law firms and to other organizations that, look, here we have this terrible, obvious instance of sexual harassment taking place in an environment where, oh my God, if anybody should have known about what the legal issues were related to sexual harassment, it should probably have been a law firm. And yet these folks made exactly the wrong choice. What they did is to rally around their managing partner instead of protecting this legal secretary, and they paid the price in court. They may have been able to weather a $7 million judgment against their law firm, but frankly, that would pretty much bankrupt almost any small business that I know of. And so you have to be very concerned as you're kind of going forward and looking at these different laws to make sure that your business is in legal compliance. Let's return for a moment to the definition that we talked about just a little bit ago. And those different conditions actually set up a kind of categorization of different kinds of sexual harassment. And I want to talk about that for just a bit. The first two parts of the definition talk about sexual harassment where it's a condition of employment or the condition of some kind of promotion. Both of those are referred to in the law by the Latin term quid pro quo, quid pro quo sexual harassment. If you went to a high school that offered Latin, or if you were somebody who dabbles in legal terminology, you may know that quid pro quo in Latin simply means this for that. It's an exchange. And in this case, it's the exchange of sexual favors for some kind of legal or employment-based favor. So if you're offering a reward or threatening punishment in return for sexual favors, that's called quid pro quo sexual harassment. And while that may be the easiest to understand, while that is certainly the most obvious and recognizable kind of sexual harassment, it actually only constitutes about 15% of the cases that get brought forward to government regulators. Only about 15% of the cases are actually quid pro quo sexual harassment. And one of the reasons there's such a small percentage is when they happen, they are either settled by the companies and it never gets reported to the government agencies, or it's so explicit and so obvious that people have pretty much figured out that they ought not be acting this way. So quid pro quo sexual harassment, at least at the federal level, only constitutes about 15% of the cases. The other type, the other cases at the federal level, and what seems to be by far the more significant number of cases, 85%, is what's called hostile environment sexual harassment. That is where sexually suggestive remarks are made, people are intimidated, or there are offensive conditions to the point where it affects the employee's work, and as a result, sexual harassment charges are brought. As you can imagine, this is the more difficult type of sexual harassment to prove in court or in front of a regulatory body. But nonetheless, it is the kind of sexual harassment that we have to educate ourselves about and educate our employees about. It's a significant issue. The typical targets for this kind of sexual harassment, for all sexual harassment, actually are, you know, it's something that's important to the people probably taking this class. College-educated women under the age of 35 working in predominantly male work areas seem to be the ones who are most often affected by sexual harassment, but by no means are they the only ones. And I want to be really clear when I'm talking about sexual harassment in this class, that the laws that protect people against sexual harassment are not simply male on female sexual harassment. It is also female-on-male sexual harassment, male-on-male sexual harassment, female-on-female, and if you want to throw in the permutations related to transgendered persons, you can do that as well. These laws protect everybody from any kind of sexual harassment. And, you know, I know, the classic case tends to be male-on-female sexual harassment, where the superior is male and the subordinate or the victim is female. There are, of course, examples in the popular culture, in the popular media, that spin things the different way. You may be familiar with a movie called Disclosure that starred Michael Douglas and Demi Moore, in which Demi Moore was actually sexually harassing Michael Douglas. And I know that there are, and this is one of the things that often makes it difficult to talk seriously about sexual harassment. I know, folks, I know that there are guys listening to this. I know there are males in this class listening to this and thinking to themselves, oh, yeah, I saw Disclosure. I saw Demi Moore. Let me tell you, Demi Moore could sexually harass me anytime she wants. Well, listen, I suggest that what you do is you pick up a copy of Disclosure, which is the book that was actually written by Michael Crichton, and try and get the image, if you will, of Demi Moore out of your head for a minute, and just read about the first 50 pages or so of this novel, and you will be completely horrified, because when it's not on the big screen, and it's just laid out in front of you the kind of situation that arose in this fictional account of female-on-male sexual harassment, I think your point of view will be very, very different. The point is that, and I often do this when I have an actual class of people in front of me, I'll ask people to do what we used to do when we were in grade school, that is to lay your heads on your desk and hide your eyes for a minute. And then I used to just ask people, how many people have ever been actually the victim of or know somebody very close to them who's been a victim of sexual harassment? And I have to tell you that well over a third of the people in the class would usually raise their hands. This is still a significant issue. It may have first, come to the public consciousness in the late 70s and early 80s, but it still continues to be an important organizational issue for folks out there in the business world. So we're going to talk a little more about this. And we're going to talk about, as I promised, sexual harassment as communication. Let's think about this for a second. If you think about what sexual harassment is and how it's accomplished, if you will, we're talking about sexual harassment that can either be the words that people say, the way that they say them, or the physical touch associated with those sexualized words. That it means that sexual harassment can either be verbal, what or how things are said, versus nonverbal. The very beginning of this class, I talked about the difference in context between being patted on the rear end by the CEO when you were out at the company picnic and just made a great play out in right field to win the softball game for your team. That pat on the behind is perfectly, probably legitimate and perfectly reasonable and not sexual harassment because there was nothing sexualized about that. However, that same touch alone with the CEO in some copy room in your offices is a different environment, a different context, and that physical touch may well be part of a pattern of sexual harassment that you would certainly want to be on guard against. A very smart professor by the name of Deborah Tannen, T-A-N-N-E-N, she's in the Department of Linguistics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and she has a theory about sexual harassment that's quite provocative. She argues, actually, that there are a significant number of cases of sexual harassment that may result simply from the differing communication styles of men and women. Tannen's done an awful lot of work on this, and by the way, let me recommend her book to you, one of her many books to you. She has a book called Talking 9 to 5, and it's about the communication patterns of men and women in corporate America. In addition to drawing on some of the research that's been done in the laboratories or on campus, she also went out and interviewed lots and lots of men and women in the workplace before she came to her ideas. And though she was trying to give a different perspective on why it is that sexual harassment happens, and I don't think there's any one explanation that explains all of it. Cannon was pretty widely condemned because by explaining that sexual harassment may arise from the differing communication styles that are inherent in men and women, she was seen by some of her critics as giving men a pass. That is, not making them responsible, because after all, if it's just in their communication style, and men and women have different communication styles, then all of this is just a big misunderstanding, and nobody is really at fault. And actually, if you read Tannen and you read her closely, that's not what she's saying at all. But she is one of the important researchers in this country trying to understand sexual harassment as an issue related to gender, as an issue related to men and women trying to communicate in the workplace, and to try and understand why it happens. Of course, for a long time, some folks researching sexual harassment have come from the perspective that in many, many cases, sexual harassment has very little to do with sex, but a lot more to do with power, and that sexual harassment is a way for people to strike back at, say, the women that they see infiltrating a previously all-male workplace. A good example of this is was seen at Continental Airlines. When they started to hire women as pilots, a practice that had been previously established under the all-male pilot corps before them became an important point of contention. Apparently, it was quite common for these Continental Airline pilots to leave for the flight crews that would be coming after them, who would be working with that plane and flying that plane. You know that in the cockpit of these large commercial jets, there are these big binders full of procedures and checklists that they work with every time. So as you get ready to land, you open up the binder related to landings and you go through the checklist. Or you're getting ready to take off and you go through the binder and, you know, there are all these lists of, you know, what switches are have to be in what position before you can take off. Well, apparently among the pilots at Continental Airline, the all-male pilot corps, there was a pretty standard practice of leaving pictures of naked women in these binders, so that when, you know, the next crew came in and they opened up the takeoff binder, they would find there, staring at them back, Miss May from Playboy magazine or something like that. Well, when women started to become pilots and working for Continental Airlines, they expressed to management that they were not particularly thrilled with this little practice, and that they demanded that it be stopped and that management say something strong about it. And sure enough, management did in fact come out and say that this was not to be tolerated, that they were men were no longer able to leave pictures of naked women in these binders for the next flight crew to find. And it's pretty clear at that point that, at least in that situation, those naked pictures became more than simply an object of titillation for the crews, that they were being also left there to remind these women pilots that they were invading an all-male bastion, that they were taking jobs away, if you will, from other men, and that they should remember that their real place in society for women is that they should be sex objects and that they ought not be flying commercial planes. So in those cases, it wasn't so much about sex once the women started to become pilots. It was probably a lot more about intimidation, an expression of power. Those are the messages likely to be sent. There is, of course, another set of theories about how and why sexual harassment happens in the workplace. And really, it has to do with more of a kind of relationship approach. And there are researchers who argue, for instance, that some sexual harassment in organizations happens not because of expressions of power, not from different communication styles, not just because people don't know the rules, but rather from failed interpersonal relationships. So, for instance, we know from experience that many of the intimate and personal relationships that you will have over the course of your life happen because you work with those people. It's simply a situation of proximity. The more you're around somebody, the more attractive they get to you, and relationships, in fact, happen. And the argument is that sometimes what is referred to as sexual harassment in organizations may be simply the result of a romantic relationship that failed, or a relationship where the interest was only going in one direction, and that really this is nothing more than an awkward attempt to woo somebody or seduce somebody or attempt to get them to recognize somebody, and that really it's about the interpersonal relationships rather than any kind of power or execution of power. Again, I think all of these theories have merit. All of these theories are backed up and can provide examples where they're true. And as a result, I'm not sure that there's any one explanation that necessarily dominates, but they all give us ways of understanding why sexual harassment happens, and they all give us ways of understanding, therefore, how to prevent it, how to resolve it, and how to make sure that the organization does its very best to respond to it. Because ultimately, when we're talking about sexual harassment as a concern of the organization, that's something that's extremely important. So in this example that I gave you about Continental Airlines, there's a kind of rest of the story to this. Although Continental Airlines seemed to respond quite quickly in condemning this practice of leaving the pictures of naked women in the cockpits of commercial aircraft, apparently what happened is that after 6 or 8 months, the practice started up again, and the women pilots were, of course, very upset that it was happening again. They went back to management and complained, and instead of, again, reiterating their position on this, the organization apparently was far more lackadaisical and simply said, look, we've already condemned this. We've essentially already did what we're going to do. These are just boys being boys, and essentially told the female pilots, why don't you get over it? Not the best response that you want to make in an organizational context like that. The female pilots took Continental Airlines to court, and they again won a multi-million-dollar judgment against the against Continental Airlines because of the nature of their organizational response. It's not enough to simply say no to people, don't sexually harass the employees. It's important that you also follow through from an organizational context and make sure that your employees continue to be protected. Let me start by dealing, when we're talking about how do you respond to sexual harassment, let's start at an individual level first, okay? Although it is likely that if people in this class are going to be having to deal individually with sexual harassment, it's likely that the females in the class are more likely to be sexually harassed than the males. Nonetheless, there are still situations of female-on-male sexual harassment, male-on-male sexual harassment, female-on-female sexual harassment. So the potential, and the argument is that anybody potentially is a victim of this kind of a problem, and that you need to be equipped to deal with it. You need to understand that there are some basic responses that you need to make. So let's talk about victim strategies for dealing with sexual harassment. Okay, the first thing that you need to do is you need to tell, if you believe that you've been sexually harassed, it's important that you tell the perpetrator of the sexual harassment in no uncertain terms that the conduct is inappropriate. Now, I think you may say, oh, well, this is so obvious. But here's the problem. We communicate in many different ways. Some of us are more competent communicators than others. And frankly, I think you need to monitor your own communication styles and skills to make sure that the message that you're sending is the message that you intended. So, for instance, if you are a female in an organization and somebody approaches you and says something what you believe is inappropriate or acts in an inappropriate manner to you, you must not respond like this. Oh, please don't say that anymore. Gee, it just makes me uncomfortable. Well, you know what? You don't sound uncomfortable if you say it like that. You sound, in fact, like you're actually flattered by the attention. And the message that's likely to be sent to the perpetrator in that case is, ooh, she's actually interested. Do it some more. In this case, the vocalics, the quality of the voice, the way in which it's said is more important than what was actually said. And I know that this is an issue related to the response that's, you know, the no versus no really means no campaign related to sexual attacks and things like that. But it's also relevant here that I'm sorry, ladies, if you are feeling uncomfortable and you want to tell somebody to stop, you need to make sure that your vocal response sounds like you're upset. You need to look somebody straight in the eye. You need to speak clearly with as direct a voice as you can to tell the person that that makes you feel uncomfortable, that you don't want it to continue, and that if it does continue, you will report it to the appropriate authorities within the organization. I think that's the first thing. Second thing is, if you are feeling like this is a continuing pattern of behavior, it's important that you follow the workplace procedures that are in place in your business or organization and report that incident to the proper authorities, to human resources, to your supervisor, whoever it is. You have to, in a sense, take control of your own life and make this report. In the past, it used to be the case that if you did not follow workplace procedures to report sexual harassment, no matter how horrible it might have been, it would have been difficult for you to prevail in any kind of a court case, because the courts at the time said, well, if you don't follow procedures, we can't protect you. Well, the problem is that some of the previous court procedures that existed in a lot of organizations were really stacked against victims. For instance, how stupid is it to have a procedure in your sexual harassment policy that says that you must report all sexual harassment to your immediate supervisor? Well, you can imagine what the problem is. What if the immediate supervisor is the one who's sexually harassing you? How can you make a report to somebody like that in that particular instance? We'll talk more about that in a minute. But the point is, you want to do whatever you can to follow appropriate workplace procedures. You also want to try and document what happened in written form. I would be very, very leery of using your company's email to try to do that. You think, oh, how do I document something in written form and make sure that it's appropriately timestamped? Aha, I will simply use company email. But you know what? Things can be made to disappear. And if you use the company email, remember, they own the email system. You don't. And you have no expectation of privacy in their email system. And they can, frankly, do with them what they want. Now, of course, if they get caught essentially trying to destroy evidence that would be relevant to a case like this, they'll be in a lot of trouble. But the point is, they would have to get caught. Finally, for victims, I think an extremely important issue is to, if there are witnesses present to an event, have them verify the details of the incident. Have them write down what they saw, what they heard, so that you don't get to a situation, as you hear in so many of these cases, where it kind of simply degenerates into he said and she said. If there are witnesses to the event, and they, it's important for them to be able to tell people what they saw or what they heard. So those are some strategies for dealing with sexual harassment from the victim's point of view. Let's shift now, if we could, to talking a little bit about organizational responses to sexual harassment. What do organizations, what do businesses have to do to protect themselves from sexual harassment and to protect their employees from sexual harassment? And, I have to tell you that sometimes these kinds of strategies are put in place by businesses and organizations not so much because they have the best interests of their employees at heart, but what they're looking for really is a defense that will succeed in court. Let me give you an example that a large retailer in the United States, I won't say Kmart, my understanding is that their sexual harassment policy for managers is that the managers go through a very extensive educational process in regards to sexual harassment. At the end of the two-day class, they are supposed to take an exam, and if they do not get at least an 80% on the exam, they're told they have to go back through the entire course. If a second time that they go through the course and take the exam at the end, if they don't score at least 80%, they are simply not going to able to be managers. They're going to be demoted back to a line employee. So the point is, big chain store can get up in court and say, but we're so serious about sexual harassment, we take such great care of our employees, that if our managers aren't able to get through this training and aren't able to demonstrate competence, we don't let them be managers. That may seem harsh, but I would argue that it's being done not so much for the protection of the line employees, but it's being done for the protection of the business so that they can go into court and make the argument that, yes, indeed, they're trying to be vigilant. So let's think about that as we go through some of these organizational responses. If somebody comes to you as a member of an organization to report sexual harassment, it's really important that you take their complaint seriously and listen carefully. You cannot afford to simply blow it off. You cannot afford not to tell somebody at a higher level of the organization about it, because there's court case after court case where the organization's behavior after the initial report becomes more serious than the fact that it happened in the first place. As with the woman who was having M&Ms slip down her blouse, it wasn't the original attack that actually precipitated the biggest chunk of punitive damages. It's the response that the organization had to the charge of sexual harassment. And so the question is, did you as an organization know, or should you have known? If somebody reports to you inappropriate behavior, you need to make sure that the organization is aware of that. A second thing that probably needs to be done at this point is that an investigation needs to be conducted. This is not the time for you to become a junior sleuth and, you know, pull out your Sherlock Holmes paraphernalia, your meerschaum pipe, and your wool hat and go about conducting an investigation in a workplace. If you have not been trained to conduct these kinds of investigations, then it's very important that you report it to somebody who has. And in large companies, they actually have people in their human resources division who are kind of trained to do these things. Or perhaps more an even safer response for an organization is to outsource it and have an independent agency. And there are consulting agencies and law firms that do these kind of investigations all the time. And the advantage is that because they're done by a third party, the organization can then say, look, what we weren't investigating ourselves, we actually brought in a third party to make sure that this was done correctly. So outsourcing an investigation may be exactly the right thing to do. If you are the member of the organization who is receiving the complaint from an employee complaining about sexual harassment, it's important that you maintain your objectivity. You can be sympathetic to the person who is providing this information or making this charge, but it's really important at this point that you don't make promises of action prior to an investigation. You may want to put your arm around this person, console them, and tell them, don't worry, we're going to get the son of a bitch who did this to you. You may want to do that, but believe me, from an organizational perspective, it is the wrong response. And that is because that until an investigation is done, until you know all the facts, even the person charged with perpetrating the sexual harassment has protections as well. They have, in many cases, a right to due process. They have, in many cases, simply because, people are presumed innocent until proven guilty. They have not been proven guilty yet. Just because there's a set of charges against them, we need to suspend judgment, in a sense. Perpetrators have rights, too. There are cases. Believe me, there are cases. One back in the at the University of New Hampshire some years ago, where once the university received a report or a charge from a couple of students of sexual harassment, the university pulled the professor from the classroom. Unfortunately, as things played out, the original charge against this professor was not proven to be true. So the professor then turned around and sued the university because they essentially acted as if he was guilty by pulling him out of the classroom. And he ended up winning a multi-million-dollar judgment against the university. So these poor women who initiated the charge got no satisfaction at all. But the professor, who, you know, may or may not have been doing inappropriate things in the classroom, he's the one who ended up with the big judgment in his favor. So remember that even the perpetrators have rights too. You can't become personally involved and say, oh, don't worry, we'll get him or we'll get her, because you have to follow the the rules and procedures of your organization. And that really leads to my last point on this. Let me say this really clearly. Let me say that, yes, this is the basis for a really good response to an exam question, but let me state it this way. The single most important thing that any organization can do to protect themselves from sexual harassment, to protect their employees, and to protect the business, to protect the organization, is to have a sexual harassment policy in place and to follow it. Many companies still, believe it or not, still don't have sexual harassment policies. Many companies simply fly blindly until they're first hit with that first charge. That's not a very smart way to approach the business environment. You need to have a sexual harassment policy, and frankly, if I was going to work for a big corporation that didn't have a sexual harassment policy, I would be very, very afraid, because that organization is uniquely vulnerable to the kind of charges that can be made in a sexual harassment suit. One of the things that organizations have to be very careful about is to make sure that they don't retaliate against those people who bring forward charges. And this is a relatively new wrinkle of the law, and frankly, this is one of the reasons why places like California require that people be educated about sexual harassment at least every 2 years. This is still an extremely dynamic legal environment that we live in. What that means is that the laws change all the time. New lawsuits and new findings in lawsuits are going to require that companies deal with these things in different way. In 2006, there was a Supreme Court decision called Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railway versus White. It was a 9-0 decision, so you know that everybody was in agreement on this. And what it did was it put companies on notice that they have to be very careful about retaliating against people who've made sexual harassment charges. In this particular lawsuit, what came to be defined was what retaliation was. What a company thinks is retaliation may be very different from what the victim of the original sexual harassment charge may perceive to be retaliation. If the company reassigns the victim in order to get them away from the alleged perpetrator, they may see that as a prudent thing. However, if the victim believes that the actions taken by the company are in fact in retaliation to her original charge of sexual harassment, that makes things worse. And the important thing here is that the courts have sided with the victims. And so that the retaliation exists, the court argued in this case, if a reasonable person would have been deterred from reporting the offense. So if a company, in reacting to a charge of sexual harassment, creates conditions that would have made it less likely that that original victim would have reported the charges to that company, they may be seen as retaliating against the employee, and it opens them up for far more punitive damages and all kinds of problems. What the court really was doing here was trying to broaden protection for workers, and it probably dramatically decreases the number of options that companies have in responding to harassment complaints. We know this is a potential problem. We've got to make sure that it's fixed, and we've got to make sure that any of the responses that an organization makes are not likely to be viewed by the victim as retaliation. If a reasonable person in the same position as the victim would have been less likely to report the abuse, then the courts have said here that that's inappropriate. As we consider what organizations can do to protect themselves and their employees against sexual harassment, here are some things to think about. When we talk about sexual harassment in organizations, it's often the people at the top of the corporate ladder who set the tone for the rest of the organizations. One of the things that was so damaging about this law firm who had this managing partner essentially sexually harassing his legal secretaries by dropping M&Ms down the front of their shirts and blouses and then going fishing for them is that it sets a tone for the rest of the organization that that organization tolerates and, well, arguably encourages sexual harassment. That's why if you're going to have a policy on sexual harassment, if you're going to say we have zero tolerance towards sexual harassment, then that commitment has to become at the very top of the organization as well. It has to be something that goes throughout the organization. There has to be consistent enforcement for all. There can't be different rules for the supervisors and managers from the people who are lower down in the organization. Here's another mistake that people make and organizations make when they try and write their sexual harassment policies. In an effort to specify and make certain the kinds of punishments that are available to perpetrators, if they find somebody guilty of sexual harassment, or if they just think that you need some discipline for what you've done, some sexual harassment policies specify specific kinds of penalties on whether or not it's a first offense or a second offense. So, for instance, a first offense, it might say in the policy that you get a verbal warning. A second offense might be a written warning placed in your personnel file. And a third offense, it might say that the employee is subject to disciplinary action, including being let go from the organization. Well, in their interest of trying to specify and make clear what the policy says for, first offense, second offense, third offense, they've really made another mistake, and that is the worst that can happen to an employee under that kind of a policy would be they get a stern talking to if they sexually harass somebody. So it kind of says to the perpetrators, if you're going to sexual harass somebody, well, make it a good one the first time, because the worst they can do is kind of yell at you. Oh my goodness, what a stupid policy. The point is to not specify specific punishments for first offense, second offense, but rather to lay out in your policy a whole range of possible options for responses to sexual harassment that may run the gamut from a verbal warning, a requirement to take a class, if it's an innocent mistake or if it seemed to be not a very serious instance, to all the way up to being terminated from the organization for a really obvious, explicit, or nasty, or aggressive kind of sexual harassment incident. Even if it's a first offense, if you get people dragging women into men's rooms, right, to sexually harass them, oh my God, you can't sit around and just put something in their file. You got to fire these people. So don't specify the first offense penalty. Make the punishment consistent with the behavior. The other thing that organizations should think seriously about doing is having multiple reporting options. As I said previously, if your policy says that you must report the sexual harassment to your supervisor, chances are that if it's the supervisor who's doing the sexual harassment, there are not going to be many reports. And so you need to give folks options. Maybe you can go to your supervisor, maybe you can go to somebody in human resources, or maybe, and a lot of companies are doing this now, they're hiring outside agencies to receive reports of sexual harassment so that the employees know that it's not being filtered through the organization. Think about multiple reporting options as a way of ensuring that you hear about every instance of sexual harassment in your organization so that you're not blindsided when something comes up later. As California law AB 1825 makes clear, companies cannot simply condemn sexual harassment or educate their employees once about it. There needs to be in place an ongoing effort to educate and re-educate their employees about sexual harassment and ultimately about how to deal with it on an ongoing basis. Doing it once, condemning sexual harassment once when you're hired as an employee, is simply not going to be an adequate defense in the ongoing dynamic legal environment for this kind of behavior. Finally, if we're talking about sexual harassment and we're talking about how can you, in a sense, is there a way to inoculate your organization to prevent these kinds of things from happening? Is there a way to kind of work with the culture of your organization to make sure that it's less likely that sexual harassment happens in your offices? Here's an important consideration. We do know that organizations that have a culture of accepting and making clear to their employees that upward communication is an expected part of your job, that we welcome comments from folks in the organization about the way in which things are being run and what the environment is like, those kinds of organizations that are more accepting of upward communication are more successful at preventing instances of sexual harassment. So if you're looking for a way to hopefully make your organization more bulletproof to prevent sexual harassment, the best thing that you can do is to build a culture that's accepting of communication that travels from the bottom of the organization up and not simply be top down. All right. The last part of this lecture is really going to look at a study that was done a few years ago, and it was done by communication researchers. And what it was looking at was the way in which sexual harassment gets reported, the way in which sexual harassment operates in organizations, but most importantly, what they were looking at was third-party observations of cases of sexual harassment. So if employee A says something to employee B that is observed by employee C, what factors in observing that interaction between A and B are going to lead employee C to think, yes, that was sexual harassment, or no, that was just innocent play or flirtatious kinds of communication? And so they coin a term that's very important here that they call social sexual communication, and it's communication that does not rise to the level of sexual harassment, but nonetheless may be an important kind of indicator of whether or not the environment that you've created in the workplace. I mean, the truth is that people talk about sex at work all the time. You come back from a long weekend, your coworker or cubicle, the person in the cubicle across the way says, "Wow, you've got a smile on your face. I bet you got some over the weekend." Inelegant, crude, absolutely. But that's called social sexual communication, and we all know that it happens at work, and it happens among men, it happens among women, and it happens across gender lines. It simply is the kind of talk that happens at the work that's related to sex. Now, at what point does social sexual communication kind of cross the line and become sexual harassment? And that's really what this study by Solomon and Williams was really trying to look at. They note, for instance, that the vast majority of sexual harassment that happens in the workplace is hostile environment kind of sexual harassment. That is, that we understand that sexual harassment is often about this hostile workplace environment. They note that this social sexual communication is often seen as the key to creating these kind of hostile environments. And they more importantly note that for many, many people, well, in this case, they estimate a third of all the relationships, significant relationships that you have with people, are initiated in the workplace. So of all the kind of serious dating partners that you may have over the course of your life, a third of those, for most people, happen because you met the person on the job. And that means that you're going to have relationships that work and relationships that fail. You're going to have frustrated relationships. You're going to have relationships that are unrequited. They only come from one side. Maybe it's not a relationship at that point. Maybe it's just being stalked. But the point is that these kind of things happen in the workplace all the time. And so what they're trying to find out is, as people observe other people having these interactions, what causes some people to look at that and say, you know, that's no big deal, that's just innocent, and other people to look at the same interaction and say, nope, that crosses the line, that's sexual harassment, and yes, I'm going to back up this person's report saying that he sexually harassed her. So they looked at that kind of information. In doing so, one of the first things they did in this study was to distinguish romantic interest from sexual harassment, because they argue, like, if one third of all the relationships you have actually happen at work, there's going to be some communication among people in the workplace that is, in fact, authentic romantic interest. Sometimes those kind of discussions are going to cross the line to what we regard as sexual harassment. And so they ask the question, how do we distinguish romantic interest from sexual harassment? A good question. And they said it really depends on two factors. The first is called the perception of constrained behavior. The perception of constrained behavior. And what that means is, if your boss asks you to go to lunch with him, if your supervisor asked you to go to dinner with her, how able would you be? Would you be able to say no? Would you be able to feel like it would have no impact on your job to say, you know what, I really can't do that today, or I'm not feeling comfortable with that kind of an arrangement, and I'd rather not do it? So are you feeling constrained? Because the more constrained you feel, the more you feel like you can't say no, the more likely it's to be seen as sexual harassment. So that's the first thing, this perception of constrained behavior. The second factor is called the perceived desirability of the sexual advance. It's more likely to be seen as sexual harassment if the third party observing the interaction feels like the person would welcome the advance. If the person observing the interaction feels like, oh, this guy's a jerk, and I can't believe that, you know, oh, she's even talking to him, and God, he's the office nerd, and get away from me, or whatever. If the advance is not seen as desirable, it's more likely to be seen as sexual harassment. So those two things work together, the perception of constrained behavior and the perceived desirability of this contact and sexual advance. So let's look at some of the results from this very interesting study that Solomon and Williams did. The first thing that they found out was that explicit advances are seen as more constraining than implicit ones, ambiguous ones. So for instance, if the boss says, accompany me on this trip over the weekend and we'll make sure you get that promotion, that is a very explicit advance. In fact, it's quid pro quo sexual harassment. And it's more likely, if you're constrained and you can't say no to some kind of an offer, by the way, if you don't come with me, I'm going to fire you, that's most likely to be seen as sexual harassment. Whereas, well, we're both at this convention, and I'd like to get together and do a little work after the last session. Why don't we go out to dinner and we can talk about things that we're getting ready for next day? Well, that's far less explicitly a sexual advance. It may be a sexual advance, but it's not obvious. It's more ambiguous. And the more implicit it is, the less likely it is to be seen as sexual harassment. So explicit advances are more likely to be seen as constraining. Therefore, they're more likely to be seen as sexual harassment. The next thing that they noted, Solomon and Williams found, was that supervisor behaviors are more likely to be seen as harassing than those same interactions entered into by peers or subordinates. And this is to simply acknowledge that power plays a role in sexual harassment. And what it should also tell you is that the same things that you might have joked about with your coworkers when you were one of them is simply or may simply not be acceptable when you're their supervisor. When you get that promotion, all of a sudden, there's something that's built into the interactions that are very different, and that is you are now their supervisors. You have a different power and status in that organization than the people you used to work with. It's one of the reasons why AB 1825 targeted people who were newly promoted, into getting sexual harassment training, because supervisor behaviors are more likely to be seen as harassing than the same message coming from your peers or from subordinates, okay? And again, it feeds in, I think, to the perception of constrained behavior. The next finding is that perceived severity of sexual harassment increases with the position power of the message initiator, which is a fancy way to say the higher up in the organizational chart you are, the more careful you have to be with your interactions with subordinates. Because if there's an extreme division or separation of power between two employees, it increases the likelihood that a perfectly innocent remark that's made, gee, that's a very attractive blouse you have on today, might be perceived as sexual harassment, whereas if it's coming from a coworker or your immediate supervisor who you interact with every day, it may not be seen as particularly threatening. So as you go higher up in an organization, you have to recognize that you have even less freedom, that you have to be more careful with the way you interact with your employees. And again, it really goes back to this power differential. the more, the wider the gap is between the two employees, the more likely it is that the position of power might be initiating some kind of sexual harassment. This next finding, I want to be very careful as you kind of read this because it can be read the wrong way. But let me remember that the second prong of distinguishing romantic interest from sexual harassment is the perceived desirability of the advance. And so once you take that as one of the markers of these distinctions, you come to a conclusion that says this, that attractiveness is related to perceived sexual harassment. And the way that plays out is this. Unattractive men, and gentlemen, we know who we are more likely to be perceived than attractive men as sexual harassers. And the reason is because if you're perceived as unattractive, then you're going to perceive, it may be perceived that your sexual advance is less desirable, and therefore, it's more likely you're going to be seen as sexual harassing somebody. Whereas attractive men have a little more leeway because it's perceived that their sexually advances are going to be more acceptable. So if you are the office George Clooney, you may have a little more leeway than if you are the office Quasimodo. Okay. Again, I'm not saying this means that if you're a good-looking guy, you get a free pass on sexual harassment. And I'm not saying if you're not a good-looking guy, merely saying hello to somebody is going to get you in trouble. But it's important that you understand that attractiveness does play, or perceived attractiveness does play into this. Next, individuals charged with sexually harassing attractive targets are more likely to be found guilty with harassing than when the targets are less attractive. Folks, this does not mean that it's open season in the organization on the ugly people. I'm not saying that it's okay to sexually harass the people who are perceived to be less attractive because, oh my God, if I talk to the attractive people, I'm going to be seen as harassing. It simply means that, again, we have to recognize that attractiveness does play into all of this. And then let me get to some of the kind of the really important conclusions in this. Well, all of these are important, but this one also is very interesting. Solomon Williams and Williams note, as many other researchers have, that there are gender differences related to harassment. For instance, social sexual communication initiated by males is seen as more constraining when those same messages are initiated by females. Now, guys, you may think that this is unfair, but it's simply the nature of the situation, that the exact same messages initiated by men are more likely to be perceived as constraining and hence harassing than those same messages coming from females. And this is the nature of a culture that is, in part and in many situations, dominated by men. That's the nature of the situation. Next, Solomon and Williams found that males are more likely to welcome social sexual communication than females, and hence women view it as more explicit and harassing. Guys are willing to talk about sex with women if women initiate it, and they think, But when women are the ones who these messages are targeted toward, women are more likely to find the same messages to be harassing. Next, women initiating social sexual communication were seen as less harassing than if the same messages were initiated by males. Again, that goes on to confirm what we were just talking about. Women have more leeway because they're not seen as powerful in an organization, where men are seen perhaps as more intimidating, more powerful, and the result is that the same messages coming from women are less threatening than the same messages coming as men. Okay, some final observations from Solomon and Williams. They conclude that observer sex is key to perceptions of sexual harassment, right? So if this third party who's witnessing this interaction between A and B, women are more likely to perceive what's going on as sexual harassment simply because they're more negative on organizational romances as a whole, right? Women are more likely to have rules that say, I don't date guys from work. Men are more likely to have rules that operationalize as something like, I only date women who have a pulse. Okay? I know. I'm being unfair to guys here, but what can I tell you? Women are more likely to be negative on organizational romances. They're more likely to view sexual harassment as a problem. well, and as they should, because most of it is pointed towards them rather than towards men. And they're more likely to show less tolerance for harassing behavior. So not only is the trigger faster, the threshold is lower. Men who communicate with women in organizations are more likely to view women as complicit. So if a woman is engaging in social sexual communication, men see this more as kind of, oops, a free pass. She's willing to talk about anything. I can be cruder. I can be more relaxed. I can initiate more explicit conversations with this woman. So, you know, this works both ways. Women have to be more self-conscious about the topics they raise with men in organizations. If we're talking about, you know, heterosexual kind of opportunities here, again, males are more likely to view women who engage in this kind of talk as complicit and therefore welcoming harassing behaviors. If you're looking for a final quote to kind of wrap this all up, I think this serves as a good one. Sexual harassment should be understood in terms of the power structures and gendered positions of males and females, which shape the meaning of social sexual communication at work. So really, both power and gender play an important role here, according to Solomon and Williams, and they help us to understand that sexual harassment is a communication phenomenon, that it's apt to be present. You really can't eliminate social sexual communication from the workplace because it's part of the normal interaction of men and women in the workplace, but there are certainly instances that people are going to have to be aware of. You have to be aware of the gender of who you're talking to. You have to be aware of your position power and their position power in the organization and whether or not there are disparities between the two. Folks, I don't have the answer to how we kind of eliminate sexual harassment in organizations. But what I am pretty sure of, that looking and understanding this phenomenon, getting an understanding of it from a variety of perspectives, not simply the legal, not simply the financial, not simply the regulatory environment, but also understanding this kind of sexual harassment as a communication phenomenon. In doing so, I'm not excusing it. I'm not endorsing it. I'm not saying it's okay. All I'm saying is if we understand it as a type of communication that we want to limit, that we want to work to eliminate, that we want to constrain, that I think that the kinds of things that I've been talking about today in this lecture will give us an opportunity to kind of look afresh at what's going on in our organizations. I've talked a little bit about the victim strategies and how you can respond to an incident of sexual harassment. I've talked about how our organizations ought to respond to incidents of sexual harassment. I've talked a little bit about the regulatory environments. And I hope, frankly, that this has given you a fresh thought on how to deal with sexual harassment in organizations. Thanks very much.